from WNYC New York Public Radio. This is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show. This is just one segment of the program. You can hear all Leonard's interviews on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
What is memory? Well, without it, we're not fully human, yet we've only begun to discover how individual memories are formed and what process turns a fleeting glimpse into a lifelong image. We strive to achieve mind over matter, but always have to deal with the reality that mind is matter. With me now is Dr. R. Douglas Fields, currently chief of the Nervous System Development and Plasticity Section at the Child Health Institute at NIH, as well as editor-in-chief of the journal Neuron Glia Biology. His recent article, Making Memory Stick, in the January issue of Scientific American magazine, inspired this segment, and I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Fields to my show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you.
You start off your article in Scientific American by discussing the movie Memento, which came out a few years ago. In it, the man Leonard has lost his short-term memory after a brain injury, and he can recall his life up to the time he was injured, but he's doomed to spend his present life not remembering what happened to him 5 minutes ago. Maybe we should listen to a little clip of that. Oh, we don't have the clip after all. Okay, so wasn't that film based on an actual case?
Yes, it was based on a case in the literature described by Milner in the 50s, patient H.M. And when H.M. was a boy, he had a bicycle accident and developed epilepsy. They weren't able to control it with drugs and so performed surgery. And they removed part of the brain called the hippocampus in the adjoining region.
This was experimental surgery?
Not experimental surgery. It was a treatment. Of course, we know much more now than we knew at that time. And it worked. It relieved the seizures. However, H.M. was unable to convert short-term memory into long-term memory.
Well, was he unique? If they were doing this, if they did it to H.M., they must have done it to other people as well.
Other patients have had similar injuries naturally and would have similar deficits. But once the result was obtained, no one ever would prescribe such a treatment again.
Because we know so much more about how the brain works as a system, an integrated system.
Exactly. And the unexpected result that a person could have perfectly normal working memory, but be unable to convert memory into long-term enduring memories was an unexpected result, and certainly not one that you could exchange for relieving seizures.
So is that how we found out that the hippocampus is really important in the process of memorizing things or remembering things?
Yes. Prior to that time, it was one of the main things. Prior to that time, people wondered what memory is. How is it related to other cognitive functions, consciousness and whatnot? And what this showed is memory is discrete, and it showed that a certain part of the region is necessary for converting short-term to long-term memory. And it showed that there are different kinds of memory, that there are these two stages of memory. Because HM could learn new things. He could read a paper, but that memory would fade and couldn't retain it.
He would remember it for the day, and then he'd wake up the next day, and he'd have to start all over again.
Exactly.
They could teach him how to do something, and he would do it perfectly well the rest of the day and then not know how to do it the next day.
Right. More like an hour.
Really?
And every time he met his doctor, he had to be reintroduced again. Yeah, but short-term memory is only transient. It lasts minutes to hour.
You can't use human guinea pigs like HM to do your research. How do you study memory in your lab?
Well, we take advantage of that. We take the same part of the brain that was removed from HM, and we take it out and put it in a dish in artificial solution, and we keep it alive.
From mice?
Exactly. Rats, usually, but also mice. And using microelectrodes, we can record and stimulate responses in this part of the brain and model memory in the dish.
How similar to the human brain is a rat's brain? We have a lot more neurons, don't we?
It's quite similar. There are differences. The basic plan is quite the same. And the hippocampus, the cellular structure of the hippocampus is very similar.
Mm-hmm. How many neurons does a human brain have?
Well, it's been estimated to be something like 10 with 12 zeros after it, a huge number of neurons. So, there are a huge number of neurons and a huge number of cells in other organs, but the difference in the brain is that every one of those neurons has to get connected to the right other neuron, and that is quite a mystery.
And everybody's does it differently, don't they? This is part of brain development is how those neurons connect and what the synapses are what connect them, aren't they? So where the synapses go is a key to what makes you you and me me?
Exactly. So memories are thought to be held in circuits, and circuits are connections between neurons. Synapses are that point of contact.
So but they're held in the circuits and not stored away?
They're thought to be held in the circuits, that's right. And so When you form a memory, you're strengthening a connection between neurons. But consider that you have 10 to the 12 neurons in the brain, all of which have to be connected up together. Each of those neurons has 10,000 or up to 100,000 connections on it. If you visualize a cherry tree, those are the dendrites. And visualize the blossoms on those branches. Those are the synapses. Each of those synapses is an input to the neuron. So you have to consider, how are you going to wire up 100,000 or 10,000 inputs to one neuron?
And because it goes differently with each person, is that the reason some people have better memories than others or can remember certain things better than others?
Well, everyone's brain is different, and part of the reason is that you can't hardwire specify a structure with genetic instruction alone. It's too complicated.
But certain people might be born with a genetic predisposition toward doing well in math and science, and others in the arts.
Exactly. Since you can't wire up the brain based on the genes, then the interaction with the environment, the activity in the brain, is what helps determine which neurons get connected, and that's different for every individual.
Do we have any idea of what happens with people who have neurological conditions like autism?
Alzheimer's disease, I'm not sure that memory deficits are pronounced in autism. Perhaps they are. It's not my field.
Well, it isn't. No one knows how much they know and how much they don't know, the ones who can't articulate it.
Mm-hmm.
So people are always surprised that they remember as much as they did, but it seems to also be limited in the same way that their other responses are limited. But Alzheimer's people had normal memory. We see that it deteriorates. So does that tell us something about how it develops? Because Alzheimer's is a kind of like a mirror opposite, isn't it?
The hippocampus is one of the earlier regions to undergo degeneration in Alzheimer's disease. And patients with Alzheimer's do exhibit the same problem, inability of to convert short-term memory into long-term memory.
My guest is Dr. R. Douglas Fields, and his article, Making Memories Stick, is in the January issue of Scientific American. What did you mean by that title, Making Memories Stick?
Well, it was just that. How do you convert a short-term memory, such as when you're introduced to a person, you can remember their name, but then it's gone in a few minutes. How does that get converted into a lasting memory, like the memory of your best friend? That can last your lifetime. Memories can be very enduring, last 80 years. What is the process that converts that short-term memory into a long-term memory?
And how can you work that out by studying parts of rats' brains in a laboratory?
Well, one is using the preparation that I mentioned. We can take out part of the brain and the hippocampus. And if you stimulate the synapse in a hippocampus in the right manner, you give it a brief shock, and you measure how strong that synapse is, it will be strengthened. But after a half an hour or so, it will go back to its original strength. If instead you give three shocks separated by 10-minute intervals, the synapse gets stronger and it stays stronger permanently. That's thought to be a transition between early and late, early and long-lasting memory.
So if I meet somebody and he says, "Hi, my name is Doug Fields," the first time I forget it, the second time I may remember it, the third time I'm likely to remember it. If it happens over the course of an evening.
One of the things that helps move things from short-term to long-term memory is repetition. It can't be repeated one right after the other. They have to be spaced out. And the other difference between short-term and long-term memory that is really quite intriguing is that long-term memory requires that genes get activated. And that can be modeled in the dish. If we put in drugs that block genes from getting activated, then what I described won't take place. You'll have a short-term memory. And the same is true in experimental animals. Their short-term memories will be fine if you give them drugs that block their genes from making new proteins, but they can't form lasting memories.
So DNA gets involved in memory?
Yes. Ultimately, DNA is what determines how to make a specific protein. So if you block that process of DNA making RNA to make a protein, you'll have a perfectly normal short-term memory, but you'll have no lasting memory.
How did you get interested in the way memory works in the first place?
Well, it was this issue that we're just talking about now, how genes can be involved in memory. When I was 14, I read an article in Scientific American about studies by Agronoff in which he trained a goldfish to swim over a barrier in the tank when he turned on a light. If the fish didn't do that, he gave him a mild electric shock, and they learned to associate that. Then he gave him a drug that blocked protein formation. And the fish could learn perfectly well, but the next day they had no memory. It was just like in the movie Men in Black when they flash that flashy device and everyone loses their memory of the aliens, yet they can learn new things perfectly well. That's exactly what happened, and that fascinated me. And the idea at the time, one of the ideas, was that memories must be coded in the DNA sequence. Why not? Everything else about our bodies is coded in the information in the DNA. And there was at the time a number of experiments in which animals were trained and the genetic material, usually RNA but also protein, was taken from the brain of a trained animal and put into the brain of an untrained animal, and the memory was transferred. So that intrigued me, so I tried to do that as an experiment.
At 14.
Right, and took the power pack off of my slot car set and used that to give the fish a mild electric shock. I trained them and removed the RNA. It didn't work. And I later tried it with rats, and it didn't work with rats either. But ultimately, that theory was discredited, even though it was published in journals like Science and whatnot. But there was a grain of truth in that, and the truth was that you really do need to turn on genes or there will not be a permanent memory.
Now, you said that you use RNA, not DNA. Now, RNA is kind of the messenger. DNA is the genetic material, and RNA is the way we create new DNA and also transmit the messages of the DNA?
Exactly. The DNA is a master copy. It has all the instructions for making any protein that can be made. But it's like the master tape. You probably wouldn't use your master tapes here for everyday use. You'd make a copy. And that's what RNA is. It's a copy of the DNA that goes out to the part of the cell that makes proteins and then quickly degrades after the protein is made.
So it's meant to fall apart the way the tape on Mission Impossible was meant to disintegrate.
Exactly, and for the same reason. You can't have memories left or instructions left around that no longer make any sense. So it's exactly.
Let's talk more about those neurons firing, the nerve cells. How do they fire? Are they like batteries?
Yeah, neurons are batteries. All cells are batteries, and it's not complicated. It's just that the salts inside a cell are different from the salts outside a cell. Salts have charges, and so you have a charge, a net negative charge inside a neuron. And when a neuron fires, channels open up that allow ions to redistribute. And what you find is that sodium ions enter and make the neuron more positive. And that's a neural impulse.
And how does that work in terms of memory?
Well, the neural impulse turns out to be very important in determining which memory should be retained. And this comes back to a theory of Donald Hebb, who was a psychologist in 1949, and he was wondering how do you form associations. And he had a theory that neurons that fire together should become strengthened. That connection should become strengthened. And so neurons fire together, wire together became a common way to say that.
And Donald Hebb, 1949, turns out to have really been onto something, but there was no way to prove it in 1949, was there?
Well, people have been working on that for a long time, and it relates not only to memory, but it relates to my interest in how the brain wires up in the first place.
So when an impulse gets fired through an axon. Let's talk about the axon for a moment. Does that mean a memory has been created?
No, it's probably a good idea to make sure we have an understanding of the terminology. So a neuron has many inputs. So it's like a microprocessor in that there are many connections to it. But a neuron integrates all that constant inflow of information and then can only do one thing. It can either fire or not fire. And when it fires, by that I mean it sends a neural impulse out its axon to then stimulate another neuron. But a neuron doesn't fire when one synapse sends a signal to the neuron. It takes many synapses to send signals at the same time to make it fire.
Is that why sometimes we have the feeling like we're on the verge of remembering something, but we can't remember it? Not enough of those neurons have fired?
Possibly. That's an issue of the difference between memory consolidation or acquisition and memory retrieval. What we know is that memory is not a unitary event. There are stages. There's an acquisition stage, and then there's a consolidation stage. And then there is also a retrieval process.
So let's talk about that. We have the short term. We know that the hippocampus is involved in converting short-term memory into long-term memory. How does that actually happen?
Well, the kind of memory we're talking about is declarative memory, and that's the memory for places and events. And the hippocampus is critical for that. And the hippocampus will put together information and then relay that on to the cortex where eventually these memories get stored. So the hippocampus is key to holding those short-term memories and making those associations, but it's not where the memory is stored permanently. One of the interesting things we learned from HM is that there are other kinds of memory, not declarative memory, that don't involve the hippocampus at all.
My guest is Dr. R. Douglas Fields, who is chief of the Nervous System Development and Plasticity Section of the Child Health Institute at NIH. He is the editor-in-chief of a journal, I'm sure only for people who really understand this stuff well, called Neuron Glia Biology. And he's written a number of articles for Scientific American, the most recent, Making Memories Stick. It's in the January issue. We will continue our conversation about how we make memories stick after we take a little break here on The Leonard Lopate Show. Stay with us. We're back with Dr. R. Douglas Fields, who's chief of the Nervous System Development and Plasticity Section at the Child Health Institute at NIH. He's the editor-in-chief of the journal Neuron Glia Biology and the author of an article in the January Scientific American called Making Memory Stick, and that's what we're talking about here on this show. And I'm sure that most listeners who are not scientifically minded have followed much of this conversation, but at times have gotten a bit lost. That's quite all right, is it? Or does it really matter, finally, if we understand all of this, other than people like you?
Well, I think there's some key things that people are interested in that I'd like to get across, and that is that there's this difference between short and long-term memory, and that they are different processes, and how the genes can be involved, and how that relates to how the brain develops in the fetal life to begin with. I think those are interesting questions.
So let's talk about that for a moment. What is the similarity between memory and fetal development?
Well, we're talking about...
Adult memory. And
adult memory, yeah. Well, we were talking about how are you going to wire up all these billions of neurons when each neuron has tens of thousands. You know, you only have 30,000 genes in your genome. One neuron can have three times that many connections. There aren't enough genes to do that. So it's a process in which the genes lay out a general plan of wiring, but then through activation of the brain, interaction with the environment, that those connections get winnowed away and pruned. So that's much like the process that goes on in forming memories. And so I wondered, how do you control genes based upon a neuron firing? I mean, everything that you experience in this world comes ultimately coded in terms of neural impulse firing patterns. That means that somehow you have to be able to control genes by neuron firing patterns, and that seemed intriguing to me.
So how does the signal get from the synapse to the nucleus to tell it to make a new memory protein?
Well, one of the things we did to study that is we took the neurons out of a fetal animal, grew them in a dish with electrodes, and we stimulated them in different patterns. And we tested the hypothesis that you could turn on or turn off a particular gene by stimulating a neuron to fire in a certain frequency, much like you tune into this radio station by the proper frequency. And we found that to be true. I could dial up the stimulator to a certain frequency and turn on a gene that would make the neurons change their structure.
Isn't there a lot of interest in finding a mystery signaling molecule?
Well, the idea was that short-term memory is held by a synapse. When it fires, it becomes temporarily strengthened. But how do you make that a permanent change? The idea was when you stimulate a neuron and you stimulate a synapse, it becomes temporarily strengthened due to some local process. Then a mystery molecule would go from the synapse to the nucleus, turn on the gene that would make a memory protein, and that memory protein would go back to that synapse and make that a permanent change. So yes, there was a lot of interest in what this messenger molecule is that would go from the synapse to the nucleus.
But you say that it isn't really necessary. Your recent research indicates that we may not need to locate this mystery molecule?
That's right. Research that we performed tested that hypothesis. It was done by Serena Dudek and myself in the lab. And what we did was we put on a drug that blocked synapse signaling. And then we stimulated the neuron to make it fire. And we looked at the genes, and we found that the genes and signaling molecules that are necessary for forming long-term memories were turned on by the neuron firing, even though all the synapses were silent. And then when we went and stimulated the synapse after having done this, we got a long-term memory.
So you didn't need anything else. It's right there. It's a little simpler. It is very complicated, but it's a little simpler than we were even making it.
Well, it is, and it kind of makes sense in a couple of ways. First of all, if you think of the nucleus as a manager in a factory, rather than trying to listen to input from all the workers in the factory, which, like all the synapses, instead it makes judgments based upon the output of the factory or the output of the neuron firing.
What I'm getting from this is that the old idea that our brain was like a computer, which is electrical, is not really accurate, that it's more, it's there's a wet, whatever we want to call it, the RNA, DNA genetic thing would suggest that there's a chemical thing going on instead, quite different from electrical impulses going from one part of the nervous system to the other.
That's true. I mean, we're always kind of held captive by our analogies. In the early days, the brain was thought to be sort of like a hydraulic process, and before that, a clockwork. And now we think of the brain in terms of computers, and that's only an analogy, and it's certainly wrong. Definitely, biochemistry is important.
Are there just one or two memory proteins out there, or are there a lot?
Well, we've been able to study that in my lab by using things called gene chips or gene arrays. And Jonathan Cohen and Phil Lee in my lab are doing this. What we do is we stimulate the hippocampus and in a way that would produce a memory. Then we take the RNA out and we put it on a gene chip. And a gene chip has all the genes thousands of genes, and the RNA binds. So what we find is when you stimulate the hippocampus to form a long-term memory, you don't get one molecule. You get hundreds of molecules, hundreds of genes activated.
In the old days, they used to think that you could just examine a brain and see how it works. So they saved Einstein's brain, and they saved, was it Stalin's brain that was sliced into little bits and pieces? Is there anything to be learned from looking at them that way?
Well, certainly there's a lot to be learned.
But not what we're talking about?
In different levels. I mean, the example of Einstein's brain that you give, one thing that they learned from examining parts of Einstein's brain devoted to in the association cortex was that it had more glia than neurons. The glia to neuron ratio was higher than in a normal brain.
And why is that important?
Well, we don't know for sure, but glia are important. It could be two things. It could be that Einstein had a very active imagination. This part of the brain, the neurons may have required more metabolic support. Glia are not neurons. They're cells that support neurons. But it could also be that glia are somehow involved in information processing in the brain, and that's a new frontier.
We still don't know a lot, do we? We know a lot more than we did, but we still don't really understand it. Do we know where the permanent memories are stored?
Different memories are stored in different places. So we're talking about
the... So that's why a stroke may affect people's memories in some cases, but not in others?
Exactly. We're talking about the hippocampus. It's important for spatial memory. So as I walked into this studio, there are neurons in the hippocampus that fire only in certain regions. So when I go back to the elevator, there is a neuron that will recognize that I'm there and fire. So that's very important. Memories for fear, like a fear of dogs, are held in another part of the brain, the amygdala. Skills are held in the cerebellum.
I know someone who seems to have a genetic fear of snakes. So that's something she actually inherited as an inherited memory?
I couldn't say. Uh-huh. You can develop a... there are certainly innate fears, but there are fears that are developed.
Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't know. In the case of deja vu, we feel like we're having a memory even if it isn't a real memory.
Well, there are false memories. A memory is not engraved on the brain. It is reconstructed from our experience. And those reconstructions can be false. You can read into events.
Calcium also plays a large part in creating memories, doesn't it?
Calcium is an important second messenger. Electricity has no direct effect on genes or even on the molecules, yet neurons communicate with electricity. But when a neuron fires, that's an electrical event, it opens channels that allow calcium ions to come in. And that calcium can interact with the biochemistry in the cell to carry on the messages that reach the nucleus.
And a protein called Krebs is really important in this process?
That's right. After calcium comes in, it activates enzymes, the protein kinases that carry signals to the nucleus. Krebs is a protein called a transcription factor. And what it does is it binds to certain parts of the DNA that will determine that this is the part of the DNA that needs to be read out. So it's an ultimate on-off switch. And I might add that the Nobel Prize a couple of years ago was awarded in part for this signaling to the nucleus in Krebs. That was by Eric Kandel and Paul Greengard.
So what is a memory? Is it a memory just a solid thing that comes back, I remember something from the past, or is it really a bunch of different things firing all together and integrating into what I would see as a memory?
A memory is definitely reconstructed. It's network circuits firing.
Mm-hmm. So it would be a little of a part from one part of my brain, one from another part of my brain, all coming together and then integrating in my consciousness?
Exactly. So memories are firing patterns, largely in the cortex for the type of memory we're talking about.
Where does Darwin fit in all of this? Are people with better memories more likely to survive in his survival of the fittest scenario?
People think about memory as being important for the past, but memory is really, important for the future. It allows us to encounter a new situation in the future and modify our behavior based upon our past experience, whether it was good or bad, or will have some survival value, so certainly.
Can memories be erased?
Memories can be erased. They can be erased in the method that I talked about earlier with blocking protein synthesis. Certainly through injuries, there can be amnesia and that sort of thing.
I mean, amnesia is a real thing? I thought it was only for soap operas.
No, it's definitely true. I mean, we all know that we can forget events, and they can be there. Penfield was a surgeon who stimulated the cortex of patients under surgery. And when he did that, he found very specific snippets of memory were read out in these patients. The patients were not anesthetized, and they could report that they were experiencing very vivid memories from the early childhood. Now, some people have said maybe these are dreams and they weren't true, but he interpreted this as indicating that we do record a lot of our experiences in the memory and have to reconstruct those.
Although there's been a lot of controversy over retrieved memories, some people see them as false memories. How do we know when a memory, our father having roasted babies in the basement, as some people have suggested, remembering under hypnosis, whether that is something that really happened or not?
The individual wouldn't know. You can't tell a real memory from a false memory. One of the ways to have a false memory is to read in information. For example, if you give people a story, you read them a story. If you name the character Helen Keller and then later ask them details about being deaf and blind, they will report that as information related to that and swear that that was in the story, when in fact it wasn't. If you'd used another person's name, they never would have done that.
Mm-hmm. So that is a perfect example of the integrating of different memories from different parts of the brain. Putting them together is something that we now have accept as a real memory.
Well, that fits with Penfield's analysis. I mean, here is a perfect memory, but it's like a videotape. It's all chopped up, and it needs to be put back together and have context to make any sense.
Well, we've run out of time, and it's my sense that we have a pretty good idea of how memory works, but we still don't have it nailed down 100%. Do you think we ever will?
Oh, I'm sure we will, and we are making great progress, and there are new drugs coming out to improve memory, and we're expanding our horizons and looking beyond the synapse to other molecules in other cells.
Other than drugs, are there any things that we can do to make our memory stick?
There are certain techniques like chunking. You can increase the amount you remember. Normally, people can remember serial data about 7 digits in a phone number, but if you conceive of the area code, for example, as one number, then you can increase that.
Some people, like the memory people, say that if you attach something to another thing, like you walk through a room and this is a good way to keep a grocery list. You think of the walking through the kitchen, you see meat, you see potatoes, whatever. And then if you visualize that when you go to the supermarket, you'll remember all the things you wanted to buy.
Definitely. Association is one way. But, you know, we take a lot of memory for granted, the skills and things that I mentioned. Let me give you another example. If you show people a picture for 5 seconds, and then you test them, you show them a series of pictures, and you test them a week later, they can remember many more than 10. I mean, how many do you think they could remember? You have any idea? 10, 20, 50. Experiments have been done, and you can recognize 10,000 images.
Really?
Yeah.
I wouldn't have come up with 10,000.
We're very adept at that. Vision is a very important part of our brain.
Thank you so much for talking. Oh, so if that's the case, what happens to people who don't have vision? Memory is different for them.
Well, certainly other parts of the brain having to deal with auditory input probably become strengthened and carry on more of those memories.
Dr. R. Douglas Fields, who is the chief of the Nervous System Development and Plasticity Section of the Child Health Institute at NIH, editor-in-chief of the journal Neuron Glia Biology. His article, Making Memories Stick, in the Scientific American's January issue, inspired this segment. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for checking out today's podcast of The Leonard LoPage Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.